Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Deep sea wreck divers court underwater danger and risk their lives in pursuit of hidden treasure. For divers John Chatterton and Richie Kohler, that treasure was a World War II German U-boat they discovered sunk off the coast of New Jersey. Official records indicated that the sub had never existed. Tonight on Point, Obsession, Deep Sea Adventure, and Secrets of War with Robert Kersen, author of the new book, Shadow Divers. But first, lifestyle mogul Martha Stewart is facing jail time tonight, but maybe less than she feared. This morning, a judge sentenced Stewart to 5 months behind bars, plus 5 months home confinement, and fined her $30,000 for lying to investigators about a suspect stock trade. After the sentence was handed down, Stewart said this outside the court.
I'm just very, very sorry that it's come to this, that a small personal matter has been able to be blown out of all proportion. And with such venom and such gore, I mean, it's just terrible.
Charlie Gasparino, senior business writer at Newsweek magazine, spent the day at the Manhattan courthouse. I asked him how Martha Stewart responded to her sentencing.
It was amazingly defiant. I didn't expect her to be contrite because I don't think that's her style. But I didn't expect her to do victory laps. I thought it was kind of a low point in a trial of many low points. I mean, she could have really got on there and said, listen, I put a lot of people through a lot of misery, or this has caused a lot of people a lot of misery, so you don't hurt your appeals. You know, you don't want to admit guilt at this point. But she really did a victory lap, and she said the charges were essentially meaningless. And I really don't think she gets it. I mean, she lied under oath. She traded stock on information no one else would have. She is charged with civil insider trading. You know, she forgets that.
Give us the picture of that defiance today, that victory lap as you describe it. What did it look like in detail outside the courtroom?
Inside the courtroom, she was contrite. I mean, I don't think she's dumb enough to go in front of Judge Cederbaum right before she's being sentenced and said, listen, this is a case filled with hot air. You know, she wouldn't do that. She was very, she nearly cried several times in front of Judge Cederbaum.
She told Judge Cederbaum, I have been choked and almost suffocated to death during the course of this trial.
No, she tried to play up how the situation hurt her and affected her and her family, and she almost broke down and cried several times. Outside the courtroom, however, it was interesting that the sobbing was gone. She had a big smile on her face, and it was, to me, it was a fascinating sort of change of attitude. And I just really think that, Martha Stewart, I'm not part of her PR team. Maybe they think this is a good thing to do, but I will tell you that I just think it was a low point for her in the trial.
She was already outside the courtroom telling her supporters to continue to show their support by subscribing to our magazines, buying our product, encouraging our advertisers to come back, and she's saying of herself, I'll be back. I will be back.
Right. Well, she may be back. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, listen, Martha Stewart clearly has a cult following, and when you have that cult following, you will have a core group of people that want you back and will always buy your products no matter what. Now, the question is, does broader middle America want to buy these products, buy the products of a convicted felon? Because she is a convicted felon right now. And let me tell you this. I mean, she got away with a fairly lighter sentence than most people thought she would get away with. But whoever thought about 3 years ago that you'd be saying that Martha Stewart is going to jail? Because she most definitely is going to jail. I mean, she's going to appeal this case, and she's hired a very good appeals lawyer, Walter Dellinger, from Washington, D.C., former Solicitor General.
Yeah.
But this is going to be a very difficult case to appeal. Very few appeals actually make it through. And, she may want to take this to the Supreme Court, but I believe Martha Stewart, in a year from now, is going to be doing jail time.
Let's look at the sentence first. Federal sentencing guidelines recommend 10 to 16 months, even for somebody who has no record and isn't considered a threat to society. She got 5 months in prison, another 5 at home, with an ankle bracelet, with that electronic monitoring bracelet. But what's the sense? Is that justice is done, or she got off easy?
Well, I mean, I think most people believe justice is done. I mean, I believe that the prosecution, the government believes justice is done. I mean, they wanted to make a point that if you're rich and powerful, no matter who you are, if you come and you lie to us and you make up some of the bizarre lies. I mean, this was, by the way, she was guilty. There was little doubt in my mind that she was innocent, that she was ever innocent of these charges. I mean, they had her dead to rights from day one. And if you're going to make up such stupid statements about a very serious case, you do deserve to get punished. And that's all they want to do. And by the way, they didn't put up a big stink about what the judge did. They just basically accepted it.
They took it. The judge said today, Judge Cederbaum, I believe you have suffered and will continue to suffer enough. She has been stripped of her title as chairman of Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia. She stepped down as a director of a country she founded and took public. I mean, but is there a sense that she's going to lose all that?
Listen, right now, I mean, in her mind, in her supporters' mind, there's a sense that she's going to, there's a sense she's coming back. The problem is that this company is badly shaken. And, you know, it was always a novelty, there was always a novelty value of this company as far as I was concerned from the beginning. You know, I wasn't sure how, you know, exactly they were making a lot of money, or were they?
In a public company
and
built on the back of one person's reputation.
On one person and, you know, essentially built on the concept of selling knickknacks and, you know, how to bake cakes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that a company that's going to, you know, take over the world? I don't think so. And I think one of the things that this suit did, besides hurt ad revenues, which it most certainly did, but it also focused people on the company's fundamentals, which I don't believe are that strong.
What's prison likely to be like for Martha Stewart? Where? What kind of circumstances?
Well, they've requested the federal Penn Women's Penitentiary in Danbury, which
Connecticut.
You know, is not I don't know if it's a country club, but, you know, listen, prison is a demeaning experience. You go there, you know, you're told what to do all the time. You know, if you talk to women that have been in federal prison, it's a demeaning experience. I mean, there are cavity checks that you have to go through. I mean, it's really a horrible, horrible thing. And for 5 months, she's going to have to do that.
And on the other side of that, and her house arrest, do you anticipate Martha Stewart back on television icing cakes, Charlie?
I do. I mean, she is a celebrity. There's no doubt. And she does have a following. And put that together and you know, there's always going to be a reality TV show, at least for her.
I will be back, she says, on her way to a prison sentence with an appeal still in between.
That's right.
Charlie Gasparino, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Anytime.
Charlie Gasparino is a senior business writer at Newsweek. He spoke with me from New York City. In 1991, deep sea divers John Chatterton and Richie Kohler launched the most challenging wreck dive of their lives off the coast of New Jersey. They carried with them the coordinates of an unexplored wreck site supplied by a local fisherman, the kind of tip that often leads divers to sunken garbage barges or some other useless pile of metal. But not this time. The team discovered one of the most spectacular underwater wrecks in recent history, a German U-boat from World War II, not 60 miles off the New Jersey coast. Close enough to listen to American radio broadcasts, close enough to launch a torpedo into the heart of American wartime shipping, but sunk and filled with skeletons and mystery. In his new book, Shadow Divers, Robert Kersen tells the tale of the diver's obsession with that wreck and its secrets. He joins me tonight. Did you know that there were World War II German U-boats just 60 miles off the American coast? Can you understand the obsession of men who would risk everything to uncover the secrets of a half-century-old submarine? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Robert Kersen, author of the new book, Shadow Divers, and a contributing editor at Esquire magazine. Good evening and welcome, Robert Kersen.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Terrific. Terrific having you on. And I have to say, in the very author's note at the beginning of this book, and it's quite a saga, you cite a German U-boat that I and I'm sure many others know well, the one that's sort of in the basement of the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. In your own childhood, I know that when I've climbed down those ladders, and I know your own childhood fascination with submarines from clambering around in that very boat.
Yes, if you grow up anywhere near Chicago, you will have an experience as a child with U-505, the captured German sub that has been on display at the Museum of Science and Industry since the 1950s. It's an amazing piece of equipment, one of the only U-boats you can explore in the world. And as a child, you see that thing, and it's terrifying even to a tourist. The idea that this incredibly potent killing machine could disappear at a moment's notice and reappear without warning to wreak havoc, not just on those around you, but on the world, it stays with you forever.
So there's the kind of intrigue of the submarine, the U-boat, planted in a very young mind. Here you are many years later, Robert Kersen, writing about a U-boat at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, 60 miles off New Jersey, with the 56-man crew still aboard, not gussied up for kids in a museum, nothing like that. How did you get connected with this story in the first place?
A friend called me and said they had heard a remarkable story. And I'd learned to take those kind of recommendations with a grain of salt. Usually, however well-intentioned the friends are, the story is less remarkable than they think. This one was a completely different story entirely. Two New Jersey scuba divers, weekend scuba divers who held full-time jobs during the week, one day in 1991 discover a Virgin U-boat off the coast of New Jersey. No government, Navy, historian, or expert has any clue which U-boat this is or who the 56-man crew aboard is. And even more amazing, the entire world of experts insists there simply cannot be a U-boat within a 100-mile radius of this location. That alone told me this might be a once-in-a-lifetime story.
We're going to hear something of that story tonight, but I want to also look at this through the eyes of a very accomplished writer who's come out with a book that's just getting all kinds of popular snap and crackle this summer. You had to have watched as books kind of this stripe, Sebastian Junger's Perfect Storm, John Krakauer's Into Thin Air, soared to such incredible popularity in the 1990s. When you first heard this story, did it strike you as the kind of adventure story that was coming back into vogue, Robert Kersen?
It did a little bit. Before I met the two divers at the heart of this story, it sounded to me like a real once-in-a-lifetime adventure story. Then I flew to New Jersey to meet the divers. I expected to spend about 2 hours with them hearing the details of the story. Instead, I found myself there 14 hours later still listening. And what I realized at that time was that this was going to be different than any adventure story I'd ever read or even heard about, because these two men at the heart of this story were so unique, complex, layered, and especially introspective that I realized this book was really going to be about them even more than it was about the U-boat and the adventure.
And above all, they were members of this deep sea diving kind of elite, divers who don't just do recreational 20, 30, 50-foot diving, but really deep diving, and along the Atlantic coast in their case.
Yes, this sport, deep water shipwreck diving, bears only the slightest resemblance to the recreational shallow water scuba diving that we're most familiar with. There might be 10 million certified scuba divers in the United States. Fewer than 200 do what these men do, and there's a good reason for it. It's the world's deadliest sport, perhaps. There are myriad ways to die without a moment's notice, many of which needn't be your fault at all.
And there's a culture that comes with it. You described it as a kind of a cowboy culture, an underwater machismo culture.
Yes. There are dive gangs in East Coast wreck diving. There are bitter feuds and decades-long rivalries. These guys, some of them hate each other and can't even remember why. This is much about exploration and about discovery, and therefore it's often about being the first person to reach a wreck and to extract artifacts from a wreck. These guys have grudges against each other, some of them. And some of them, like the two divers at the heart of my story, John Chatterton and Richie Kohler, personally despise each other at one time.
And in the process of trying to learn the secret of this sunken German U-boat, practically lose everything. I mean, they make a friendship in the end, but their fortunes, their families, even their lives, men died trying to figure out what was up with this submarine.
Yes, this wreck, this U-boat, was a real man-eater. Way too deep for anybody to be diving it with any good sense, and terribly, terribly dangerous inside. Even in Chicago, when you walk through the U-boat as a tourist, it's dangerous. You bump into things, you hit your head, you trip because it's such a cramped interior. Underwater, 230 feet down, where human beings were not intended to go, and when you're wearing 175 pounds worth of equipment, there are any number of ways to get marionetted into the wreck, mummified, and never come out.
Robert Kersen, we've got to take a short break. We're going to come back and hear much more about
the new book. We're talking tonight with Robert Kersen, author of Shadow Divers, one of the summer's big buzz books about obsession and deep sea diving and sunken mysteries of war. You can join the conversation. Did you know there were German U-boats lurking and sinking 60 miles out of New York Harbor in World War II? Do you understand the obsession of men who would risk and lose their lives in the deep to uncover the secrets of a half-century-old submarine? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Robert Kersen, author of Shadow Divers, one of the summer's big buzz books about obsession, deep sea diving, and sunken mysteries of war. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you understand the allure of deep wreck diving? What makes a sunken ship, a sunken submarine in this case, so much more fascinating than one afloat? And can you imagine turning over a bowl 230 feet down and finding a swastika 60 miles off the coast of New Jersey? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Kersen, I wonder if you'd dip into the book just a little bit to give us a sense of this diving culture you're talking about. There's a passage that starts on page 22. I wonder if you'd just read that for us to give us an insight here.
Sure. Deep shipwreck diving is among the world's most dangerous sports. Few other endeavors exist in which nature, biology, equipment, instinct, and object conspire, without warning and from all directions, to so completely attack a man's mind and disassemble his spirit. Many dead divers have been found inside shipwrecks with more than enough air remaining to have made it to the surface. It is not that they chose to die, but rather that they could no longer figure out how to live. The sport bears only passing resemblance to its cousin, the resort area single-tank scuba familiar to the general public. Safety statistics are difficult to divine. Deep-wreck divers make up a minuscule percentage of the world's 20 million or so scuba divers. Their accidents barely blip on the excellent safety record of a sport in which nearly all the participants stay in shallow tropical waters, depend on partners for safety, and desire little more than lovely scenery. In the United States, of the 10 million certified scuba divers, it is likely that only a few hundred dive deep for shipwrecks. To those few, it is not a matter of if they will taste death, only of whether they'll swallow. If a deep wreck diver stays in the sport long enough, he will likely either come close to dying, watch another diver die, or die himself. There are times in this sport when it is difficult to say which of the three outcomes is worst. Deep shipwreck diving is unusual in another respect. Because it confronts man's most primordial instincts, to breathe, to see, to flee from danger, the layperson need not strap on the equipment in order to appreciate the peril. He need only contemplate the sport's dangers. They are his dangers, too. And in learning about them, he will begin to comprehend the deep-wreck diver and feel his stories. He will understand why capable men give up underwater. He will know why most people in the world would never consider chasing a fisherman's numbers 60 miles out and 200 feet down into the middle of nowhere.
Robert Kersen reading from his new book, Shadow Divers, and that is exactly what the protagonists of the book have done. We're going to look at those men and how they got onto this sub in a moment. But first, I wish you'd just set the table historically for us. What was going on with German submarine traffic that close to the U.S. coastline in World War II? How busy was it out there? How much traffic was there of U-boats?
Well, in the beginning of the war, U-boats crept to within a mile or a mile and a half of the U.S. East Coast and did it with impunity. They were so close that they were able to raise their radio antennas, tune in the New York jazz radio stations they loved so much, and dance around to the music that was prohibited to them in Germany. They could watch couples strolling through their periscopes, and they could smell the greens of the forest. That all changed in the middle of the war. The Allies used ingenious technology and turned the tables completely on the U-boats. They turned the hunters into the hunted. And by the time the late war U-boat man sailed, especially if he sailed for America, his statistical life expectancy was barely 60 days.
Did Americans during the war know that there were, at least in the early years of the war, U-boats prancing around, you know, right under their noses, right off the coast?
There was talk of it. The United States government did what it could to prevent the widespread knowledge of just how close these U-boats were coming. It would have terrified the nation even more than it was already had they known. But there was a lot of talk about it and even some wild speculation. People claimed to see U-boat captains mingling in the grocery stores, buying bread and going to prom dances. There was a lot of talk. And I'll say it was such a terrible time that even civilians like deli countermen and accountants flew private planes in their off time as members of what was called the Civil Air Patrol hunting for U-boats. That's how terrifying the threat was. No one knew where they were.
And even years after the war, there was a lot still unknown, it turns out, about many of them, and certainly about the U-boat that's at the heart of this book that John Chatterton and Richie Kohler went after. How did a U-boat lost and forgotten for so many years and completely off the radar screen, even of the Nazi Navy, the Nazi High Command, how did it somehow come back on the screen of an American fisherman, American divers?
No one would still know about it if it hadn't been for a single fisherman from Brielle, New Jersey, who one day found a miraculous fishing site. The tuna and cod and pollock seemed to leap onto his fishing poles. He knew, as an experienced fisherman, that that meant the fish were gathering around something. Marine life gather around objects. And he could see a bump on his bottom finder that indicated a mass at 230 feet. He knew in all likelihood that this was just a pile of rocks or perhaps a junky pipe barge, but something was pinging in his instinct. He needed to know what it was. He only knew, though, one man capable of diving to such a depth to check this out. Now, the fisherman should never have shared the location of his find. Those locations are golden to a fisherman, especially if he's the only one who knows. But he couldn't contain himself. Something was going on in his instinct. And so he bled the secret to these divers, John Chatterton and the captain of a dive boat, Bill Nagel, who decided, because they were men of exploration, that although it was a 99% chance that there was nothing there to find, they had to go look.
What is it for divers like Bill Nagel, John Chatterton, Richie Kohler, when they hear a fisherman say, there's a bump down there, what's the mindset that makes them just crazy to get out there and risk their lives, get into the bottom of the ocean to find out what it is?
The slight chance that they might intersect with a moment that stopped time in history is what drives them completely. A virgin shipwreck, one that has never been seen since the moment it sank, is an immediate handshake with history. It is a direct connection from half a century ago between the people who perished on the ship and the divers. Unobstructed by museum ropes or by curators, it's an immediate connection. And that sense of discovery and the sense of connectedness to the past is what drives the divers who live for exploration, like Nagel, Chatterton, and Kohler did.
And give us a sense of the two men who actually went down, and then a much larger team as well, two of whom ended up dead. But John Chatterton, Richie Kohler, what kind of backgrounds? How did they, was this something they did for a living?
No. Chatterton was a commercial diver by trade, which meant that Monday through Friday he did underwater construction jobs near Manhattan. But he did those in a hard hat and connected by oxygen supplies to the surface, very different from scuba diving. Richie Kohler owned a family glass business. The men could not have been more different. Each despised each other going into this discovery, not only personally, but for what the other represented. To Chatterton, diving was about beauty and about art, and it reflected on how he had constructed his life. He was a man of immense bravery, already a legendary medic in Vietnam who was known as crazy for walking point and going into battle and risking his life every day. Kohler was part of an East Coast dive gang known as the Atlantic Wreck Divers, some of the greatest divers in the world, but they also put a high value on salvaging artifacts. If 20 teacups was good haul from the wreck, then they wanted 21. And Chatterton despised this. It was not about artifacts to him. So each man hated each other, and they had bad blood and bad histories going back a long ways. It turned out, though, that after the discovery of the U-boat, each recognized in the other that he was involved in this quest to solve this mystery for very much deeper reasons than just the effort to rewrite history. Something basic and fundamental was going on in each of their characters.
And all of that played out as they risked everything to get down to this boat. Talk to us very specifically about the dangers of deep sea divers. Of course, most of us will not have ever have had the experience. What are they up against?
Primarily, they are up against two huge dangers. One is called narcosis. When you go deep in the water and you stay for any amount of time, nitrogen builds up in your bloodstream, and that causes a fogging of your judgment center, your motor skills, coordination, so that anything you're trying to do becomes more difficult. Niggling annoyances seem like gigantic catastrophes, and huge problems seem like minor things to be dealt with later. Some people can't tie a simple knot. Some people don't remember which way a door opens when they're at those depths. The other primary danger is also related to accumulated nitrogen, and that is that deep wreck divers or deep water divers owe what's called a decompression obligation. That means that unlike the resort area scuba diver, the deep water diver cannot simply surface if there's a problem in the water. He must come up slowly, stopping at predetermined depths to allow the discharge of nitrogen. That might not sound like a huge deal, but it requires the deep water wreck diver to shout down millions of years of evolution should he run into a problem. If he can't breathe, if he gets trapped, if he gets lost, he cannot simply surface. He must stay underwater and solve the problem.
And that can lead to some pretty hairy situations. We're talking tonight with Robert Kersen, author of the new book, Shadow Divers. You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're going to hear more about this story, but I want to let our callers in. Phil is calling from New York City. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Great. Thanks.
Great story. I remember as a kid growing up in the city that every 8 or 10 years, the police or the Marine Patrol or the Coast Guard would find a torpedo that one of these submarines had just fired off from coming into the Verrazano Narrows. And it was always intriguing, you know, 20, 30, 40 years later, there would be some evidence of the war at our doorstep.
Right there in New York Harbor.
Right. Also on Long Island during the war, a German submarine came into Amagansett and let off some spies who I believe were captured by a teenager who was walking his dog and had a shotgun. But there are different versions of the story, and it's a long time since I've heard any of them.
But that's the war coming right under people's noses, right up off that coast.
I wanted to make a bigger point as I was listening to the story. Maybe some people will disagree with me. It relates to weapons of mass destruction. You know, 50 years later, you can find a submarine in our front porch. Maybe a year or two or three from now, we'll find a chemical lab in Syria or some obscure spot in Iraq, and the whole situation will change. Anyway, thanks for the story. I'm going to get the book. I look forward to reading it.
Phil, thanks for your call. Robert Kersen, take us back just for another second there to that activity during World War II. Was American shipping torpedoed right in New York Harbor or near it?
Yes, and there were saboteurs dropped off by U-boat on the American East Coast. That's true. These torpedoes, by the way, which are found, pose a great danger to divers and to salvagers. And John Chatterton even found a very small little gas canister that he brought home hoping it would reveal some kind of writing. He left it in his garage over the weekend to dry out. This was just a small little canister. When he came back on Monday morning, the thing had exploded and tore up his entire garage. So out of 50 years back, it seemed to Chatterton and Kohler that this U-boat, even in little ways, was fighting back and was still live and armed.
You go where there's trouble, and trouble may come to you. And, of course, Phil points out, you know, things can surface many, many years after war, and certainly did in this case. Let's get another call. Bill is calling from Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi there.
Hi.
I got some story that is related to all of this.
Let's hear it.
This happens in the Piscataqua River. I was stationed at New Hampshire, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and I was taken to a site. I don't remember if it was the Kittery Bank or the Portsmouth Bank of the Piscataqua River. And there was two grave sites, and the people that showed me that told me that there were German civilians or German Navy men in civilian clothes, and they would walk up and down the streets. They had tickets for theaters in their pockets. And they had artifacts in their pockets, too, that gave them that they were seamen from the German Navy.
And they thought that these were German bodies in this grave along the shore?
Yes.
And how would they know that, as opposed to any other kind of nationality of body?
You got me by that. But if it was, I would say that if it was somebody from the cities or if somebody from the states, they would have found someplace else to bury them rather than on the banks of the Piscataqua River.
And there's a memory pulled right up out of those World War II years. Bill, thanks so much for your call. So we feel ourselves in this, Robert Kersen, that kind of invisible U-boat activity right along the edge of the nation. But here we've got a boat sunk 60 miles out. When John Chatterton and Richie Kohler first began diving, what was their theory about what it was doing there?
Well, they had no theory, but they knew so little about doing historical research that they believed it would just be a matter of an hour or two when they got back to shore. They would open a book and figure out which U-boat this was. They were shocked to learn that there not so much as a puff of smoke had been recorded as occurring within a 100-mile radius of this site. That caused them to undertake a 6-year quest at huge cost, as you pointed out, to their families and to the lives of others. 3 men died diving this wreck, and nearly cost them their emotional stability. But they became, in the process, expert historians. They learned military German. They found themselves in Germany, in London, in Chicago, researching, and started to realize that if they allowed for the possibility that written history and top historians might be wrong, and flat-out wrong at that, then anything was possible. And it was that realization that allowed them to take the first major step forward in solving a mystery that the rest of the world couldn't budge.
So they had a diving challenge here and a research challenge. What was the German government's response when these two American divers showed up saying they'd found a U-boat in this particular spot? Why didn't they just identify it?
Well, they looked, and the United States Navy looked, and then everybody assured Chatterton and Kohler there simply could not be a U-boat here. We have accounts of U-boats. We have accounts of all kinds of action in this part of the world, in these waters. Nothing happened there. It wasn't until Chatterton produced a videotape and photos of the artifacts that had come out of the wreck, including the dishes stamped with the eagle and swastika, that the governments realized that they were onto something, but they couldn't help. They simply had no record of anything. And more than that, Chatterton and Kohler realized early on that the governments, while interested in this find, weren't going to do anything on their own to solve the mystery. If Chatterton and Kohler didn't do it, and didn't do it in between their full-time jobs and obligations, no one in the world was going to do it.
What did they find when they first went down to the U-boat sunk on the ocean floor? How deep, and what did it look like when they first approached it?
It looked pristine, almost exactly like the one in Chicago looks, except that it had a huge wound to its center control room section. And the wound was so major and so cataclysmic that Chatterton and Kohler knew right away that the U-boat had met its end in a very violent fashion. This was not an internal equipment malfunction. It wasn't even a depth charge. This was something major. And they had taken video to some experts, and those experts came up with some crazy theory. But the theory sounded legitimate to them, and that was this U-boat was sunk by a torpedo. But whose torpedo? They did more research in all the archives in D.C. and Germany and London. There was not so much as a puff of smoke, let alone the firing of a torpedo, anywhere near here.
In spite of the fact that there were 50, the skeletons of 56 German submariners on that submarine, on that U-boat.
Yes, the interior of the submarine is described by Chatterton and Kohler as a boneyard. You can't turn anywhere without seeing skulls and femurs and bones everywhere.
We're talking tonight with Robert Kersen, author of Shadow Divers, one of the summer's big buzz books about obsession, deep-sea diving, and sunken mysteries of war. You can join the conversation. What does it mean to scavenge among the remains of the human dead, even the half-century-old remains of Nazi soldiers? And why do we love yarns like these of crazy obsession and go-for-broke risk deep under the sea? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Robert Kersen, author of Shadow Divers, the true adventure of two Americans who risked everything to solve one of the last mysteries of World War II. You can join our conversation tonight. Can you understand the obsession of men who would risk and lose their lives in the deep to uncover the secrets of a half-century-old submarine? Are you ready to sign up for the next Chatterton-Kohler project? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Robert Kersen, I wish you'd read just a bit more for us from the book, maybe from page 47, where John Chatterton first really engages with the U-boat wreck 60 miles off New Jersey.
Sure. Chatterton continued along the top of the wreck. Narcosis began to hum as muzak from the background of his brain. A few seconds later, he spotted a hatch. He stopped. Barges did not have hatches like this. He swam closer. The hatch was angled into the mass. Hatches are not supposed to be built at angles. They're meant to allow people and things to enter ships, so they're supposed to open straight down. Who would build a hatch that angled into a ship? Chatterton pushed his head inside the hatch. The interior of the mass lit white under his headlight. This was a room. He was sure because the walls were still there. A startled fish with a wide face and fang whiskers swam past Chatterton's mask, looked him briefly in the eye, then U-turned and disappeared back into the wreck. Visibility was excellent in this enclosed space, protected from ocean particulates. Against one of the walls lay a shape. Chatterton stayed motionless and took it in. This shape, he thought, is unlike any other shape in the world. Chatterton's heart pounded. Was he seeing things? Was he more narked than he believed? He closed his eyes for a moment and opened them again. The shape was still there. Fins, propeller, cigar body. A shape from scary books and terrifying movies. A shape left over from childhood's imagination. A shape of power. A torpedo. A complete, intact torpedo. Chatterton's body heaved. He began a two-man dialogue with himself, partly to check his narcosis, partly because this was too much to discuss alone.
Robert Kersen reading from Shadow Divers, and this just the beginning. It was a six-year odyssey before it was all done. What did their goal become, and how bad did it get along the way as things began to fall apart before they came together?
It got so bad that each man lost his marriage. Each man came close to losing his emotional stability. Each man consistently risked his life in this wreck, even as other divers swore never to go near it again. It was a killer, this wreck. But each man was in pursuit of something even more than solving the mystery, and for that reason, they pushed forward in an almost insane way. They might have even solved this mystery earlier, but decided that they would not look through the pants pockets and shirt pockets and other personal belongings of the remains on board. And when you find something out like that about these men, Chatterton and Kohler, you realize that this was a much deeper pursuit than just an answer to which U-boat this was. Something fundamental was going on inside them. They were operating by principle here, and they were not willing to violate that principle even should it cost them their lives.
And what was their goal? Simply to figure out what this wreck was, to find a fortune somehow in this project? What exactly were they after?
Well, the practical goal was to identify the wreck. But the more substantive goal for Chatterton was to see who he was as a person. Were the principles that he defined his life by and defined his diving by legitimate, or were they going to fail him at the moment when life asked the most of him? For Kohler, it was much different. He had a pride in his own German heritage reawakened with this discovery. And his mission, the mission of his life, became to identify the whereabouts of these fallen crewmen for the families, loved ones, and friends back in Germany.
Jay is calling from Yonkers, New York. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to add something about the prevalence of the U-boat activity off the coast of the United States. In early 1942, the German Navy launched Operation Drumbeat, which put about 25 of these U-boats up and down the coast. And in some of the reports that I read in a book entitled Operation Drumbeat, the crew members could actually see headlights of cars driving along the coast of Long Island. And there was even one report that was later written up in a Saturday Evening Post article where many volunteer yacht owners and powerboat owners who would go out and patrol, one incident where a boat happened to come up right next to a servicing U-boat. And the officer on the board of the U-boat, according to this article, yelled at them in a almost American-tinged accent, "What are you guys doing here? You want to get hurt? Get out of here."
That sounds like a good idea and pronto. Jay, thanks a lot for your call. Robert Kersen, we've just got another couple of minutes here. Give us a sense of how this story ends. We know that they succeeded. How did they begin to close in on what was actually up with this mysterious U-boat at the bottom of the sea?
They allowed their minds to expand to permit that history was wrong. And when that happened, they started to look at documents recently declassified that spelled out the whole situation, an incredible answer to a great historical mystery. But there were documents no one in the world had thought to look at because the case seemed so conclusively closed the other way. This U-boat was conclusively believed to have been sunk off Gibraltar, 3,600 miles away. When Chatterton and Kohler started to allow for the possibility that history was fallible, they opened themselves up to finding these new documents. They then pieced together the last days of this U-boat and really solved the mystery while on land. But that was not enough for them. This was about doing something excellently, the most important thing in their lives. So even though they knew towards the end with 99% certainty which U-boat this was, they still needed to go inside the wreck and to the most dangerous spot in the wreck completely to pull proof, physical proof, from the U-boat.
And that proof was?
The proof would be an identifying tag or other piece of equipment with the name of the U-boat stamped inside. That was the only thing that would satisfy them on this mission.
It's an incredible story. And can you tell us where it was actually torpedoed? How does it turn out? Who sunk this U-boat, the object of their obsession?
Well, that's one of the great payoffs to this book. I don't know if I want to ruin the ending to it, but it is an amazing tale. And it, in fact, was a torpedo. And the end of this U-boat was a terrible trauma and an unexpected trauma.
That left 56 German submariners there waiting for half a century for two Americans and a dozen more to come and find them at the bottom of the sea. Robert Kersen, thanks for a taste of this tonight, for a taste of a deep-sea diving culture that many of us have never known. Some may be tempted, others would just read about it, let's say. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. It's my true pleasure.
Robert Kersen, author of Shadow Divers, The True Adventure of Two Americans Who Risked Everything to Solve One of the Last Mysteries of World War II. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Bedia for our Friday wrap-up. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Suddenly, a 1,000-pound bomb exploded, leaving a huge crater 4 feet deep, about 10 feet round. It knocked people flying.
We will bring the criminals to justice. We think and believe this is in response to the recent arrests in the last two days, where we have captured some prominent criminals.
For any mistakes made, as this report finds, in good faith, I of course take responsibility. But I cannot honestly say that I believe getting rid of Saddam was a mistake at all.
We hear a lot about weapons of mass destruction, and we are worried about weapons of mass destruction because of the potential to kill thousands. Here we have an epidemic that is killing millions. What is the response?
In the course of human history, there has never been a greater threat than the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Allow me to enjoy my retirement by showing that you can rise to the challenge.
I'm just very, very sorry that it's come to this, that a small personal matter has been able to be blown out of all proportion. And with such venom and such gore, I mean, it's just terrible.
The regulation of tobacco includes a host of new controls on cigarettes and other tobacco products. The farmer buyout pays tobacco farmers to exit the federal tobacco growing program.
I think what he really wanted to do is to demonstrate to that portion of his base that's hostile to civil rights, that still reveres the Confederacy, that he won't be kicked around by the NAACP.
The president may be too busy to speak to you now, but I got news for you. He's going to have plenty of time after November 2nd.
I'm running with a great American in Dick Cheney. He's a solid citizen.
He's made it very clear that he wants me to run again, and he's been very clear he doesn't want to break up the team.
I have made my position clear. I believe that a traditional marriage, marriage between a man and woman, is an important part of stable families.
This constitutional amendment is an attempt to appeal to our prejudice
instead of to our compassion, to our fears instead of our dreams. The constitutional amendment is an appeal to what is worse than us instead of what is best in us.
Americans of all different backgrounds all support traditional marriage. They know that if possible, a kid should be raised, kids should be raised by a mom and a dad.
And there is a week. Two car bombs and the assassination of the governor of Mosul wreak havoc in Iraq. In the UK, the Butler Report clears Prime Minister Tony Blair for pre-Iraq war intelligence failures. In Bangkok, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan calls for greater U.S. leadership in the war against AIDS. Nelson Mandela was there, too, demanding greater commitment from the international community to fight the global AIDS pandemic. Martha Stewart is sentenced today to 5 months in prison. The Senate approves a $12 billion buyout of American tobacco farmers and new federal regulation of cigarettes. NAACP Chairman Julian Bond lashes out at President Bush for refusing to speak at the 95th annual NAACP convention in Philadelphia. John Kerry, however, did speak. Vice President Dick Cheney rejects rumors that he might be dropped from the Bush re-election ticket, and the U.S. Senate rejects a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. There it is, Jack. Quite a week.
Quite a week and two historic events. The Senate turned down the first amendment to the Constitution that would limit rights. So that was a historic, that was a first turning it down, but the real first was that such an amendment was proposed. And advocates of the ban on gay marriage pointed out, and possibly correctly, that without a constitutional amendment, eventually this is going to go to the Supreme Court. And they cited the Lawrence v. Texas sodomy decision of 2003, which uses the language of the 14th Amendment, equal protection of the laws, to apply to consenting sexual relations among adults.
So we may see more change here before we see less.
Well, yes, and we're going to see states banning it. I think we're going to have some votes on that in the fall. But those will be appealed. One of them will be appealed to the Supreme Court, and Judge Scalia has warned that the logic for approving gay marriage, equal protection of the laws, was there in the Lawrence case.
Health in the news this week with cigarettes, but also with obesity, Jack.
Yeah, that's really something. The government has now declared that it's a disease, and Medicare will pay for perhaps even stomach stapling for people who are obese and for diets for the elderly, which is great. But, of course, the problem is kids, and they need the help, and I don't know that they're going to get it. But this reminded me of the Surgeon General's report in 1964 on smoking and cancer. That really, that began a 40-year campaign on the part of the government to educate the public about the dangers of smoking. And by gosh, that's one of the most successful public health campaigns in history. I hope something like that can happen with obesity.
I don't know if we should staple the stomachs or just weld the refrigerator door
yeah,
closed.
Right,
meanwhile,
right.
The presidential campaign just continues to roil along as we head toward convention time, Jack.
Yeah, you know, and last week I was talking about how with all this bad news from Iraq, Bush is still, you know, the public is still right with him, even though they don't agree that we should have gone in there and all the rest. And now, you know, you can see the same thing with domestic stuff. Just this week I've seen headlines that say Bush planned to cut overtime pay. Then another one, Bush Medicare plan to cut employer insurance for Medicare recipients. Now, those are just facts. But that sort of thing hasn't affected him, apparently. And he's, you know, when they say in baseball, he's hanging around. He's taking a beating. John Kerry has got to close this sale or begin to close it within the next 2 weeks. Or I think Mr. Bush is in pretty good shape. I mean, he's withstood the worst.
He may be taking a beating, but the body language doesn't look like a defeated incumbent.
Not at all. He is fighting, and his people are with him, even in the face of bad news at home and abroad. That shows that he's connecting, crucially, with his voters, and there are a lot of...
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And a great weekend to you as well, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.